Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Thousands of Pennsylvanians have died of drug overdoses over the past 5 years. Heroin was most often the culprit in the deadly overdoses, sometimes laced with other chemicals like fentanyl. Pennsylvania is not alone. The opioid crisis has reached epidemic proportions and is sweeping the country. Many times, the user starts with prescription opioid painkillers and then moves on to heroin, which is much cheaper. The bottom line is too many people are dying. Even though many first responders and police are equipped with naloxone, which can literally bring an overdose victim back to life. We talk about this issue often, but sometimes it's from a wide angle. Today, we have two people who see it up close and personal on a daily basis. Joining us in the studio today, York County Coroner Pam Gay. Ms. Gay, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also joining us is Andrew Gilger, who is a paramedic, performance improvement lieutenant at Lancaster EMS. Mr. Gilger, welcome to the program.
Morning, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Pam Gay, I'm going to start with you. As I just said in the introduction, I mean, we talk about this very often on this program and our newscast. I mean, it has reached epidemic proportions across the country, but you see it, you see the results of it on a daily basis. How bad is it out there?
Well, it's still very bad, and we think it will be for some time yet, unfortunately. But you got to remember, this problem didn't happen overnight. This was largely connected to the prescription drug problem that you referenced, which was 10 to 15 years in the making, basically. We've created a society, unfortunately, that was using these drugs that were really intended originally for end-of-life care. And so what was happening is there were more restrictions being placed on those drugs and crackdown on and also the price going up. People reverted to heroin. It was just less expensive, more easily available. And so that's what we have right now. I came into office in 2014. Our heroin deaths had been 17 the year before, slowly creeping up from, 2 years before that. But definitely I walked right into the epidemic, because by the end of 2014, we were at 62 heroin-related deaths. So hardly any fentanyl back then, that first year. Fentanyl started being mixed in 2015, and now we see fentanyl in almost all of our heroin-related deaths. Almost all of them, yeah. So
you're right. You did walk right into it, but you've been very outspoken, been one of the leaders on this issue talking about it. So has that been the big change, fentanyl? I mean, obviously, a change is that we're seeing more, but is fentanyl, and explain why, for those who may not be familiar with this, why fentanyl is so dangerous?
Well, fentanyl itself is used, obviously, in a hospital setting, that type of fentanyl. This is a different fentanyl. It's used for anesthesia and pain management, along with anesthesia and pain, and as a pain management in the hospital setting. But also, this fentanyl is not standardized. This is street fentanyl. It's, there's no guarantee. And so it's approximately 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine, dozens of times, if not 50 times stronger than heroin. And so it can, it can kill. It's so much more potent. It does much the same thing. It slows the respiratory center of the brain, tells the brain to stop breathing, and they eventually, quickly stop breathing. We have people who die with a needle in their arm. Sometimes there's fluid in that needle still. That's how quick this works. They die slumped over in whatever, sitting position they were. And even if they were breathing slowly when they were slumped over, they're not able to even raise themselves up to start breathing again, and they die in that position. So
the psychology behind this is interesting in that, people, if they are thinking straight, would say, well, I'm going to stay away from that because, it can kill me. But the psychology is that you want to get, I say you, meaning the people who are using, want to get higher, right?
Well, they do initially, and that's kind of the stereotype that I had in my mind, because I knew nothing, hardly anything about heroin when I took this job. I was a nurse, but I had never really worked around heroin addicts that much. And so it was, you would think that would be the common sense thing, but what's happening is there's an entire chemistry in their brain that after that first high or two, they don't really get that high anymore. They're trying to use from to keep from being sick. Their withdrawal is so intense that they're using to keep from being sick. And most of them will tell you that's what they were doing, the ones that survive. And so the chemistry of that brain is totally distorted because, you know, that particular chemical, you know, the heroin itself, is what's causing a huge release in the dopamine receptors, which would be the pleasure receptors in our brain. And for some people, you know, they may not get that same intense, you know, high from the heroin, but for many people they do. And so that particular chemistry is what's taking place, and it's really hard to find anything that's going to top that. So they basically use to try and get that, you know, release. But at the same time, you know, most of them will tell you as they're using, you know, even after a few days, they're using mostly just to keep from with the withdrawal. So.
You said that in York County, you went from 17 to 62. Mm-hmm. How about so far this year?
Well, this year so far, we're trending much higher. Unfortunately, we had, by the end of February, we had already had 30 suspected heroin deaths, which we had 76 all year last year. At this point, we have 26 confirmed, another 17 that we're waiting on that are probably going to come back positive. So it has thankfully slowed a little bit over the last month or so, but that's still you know, approximately 43 till it's all said and done and they come back, that, you know, 76 all year last year. So that's pretty, it definitely picked up. And I know that Lancaster has picked up too, because I just saw that they had 50 in the first 3 months. Yeah. So.
And we're going to talk about Lancaster, and really many of these statistics hold true for our whole listening area. I mean, some counties are bigger than others, have a bigger population. But before we move on to that on the ground, what we see on the ground that the paramedics see, I remember when you did come into office and you started talking about this. At the time, I thought to myself, okay, and in York County, you were out there as one of the leaders. There were people in the district attorney's office. You had a drug task force. That there was a lot of talk about this and ways to stop it. You know, education, we often hear that that's the way that this is going to slow down. I don't know if we'll completely stop, but at least if people are educated, maybe they don't start in the first place. So here we are 3 years later, and we're trending upward. So I'm not saying the education hasn't worked, but I have to say I'm a little bit surprised that it hasn't slowed down because we've been talking about it so much.
Again, I would go back to the whole prescription drug problem. I think, you know, you got to remember that was brewing in the time frame of those 10 to 15 years. And so we do believe that it's not going to significantly reverse at this point, at least for a few years. And part of that problem is, too, that there's this constant flow. Now you have fentanyl coming in through Mexico, you know, as well as heroin. And so I think that's a large part of it. The supply is just constantly flowing. We've heard that sometimes with the legalization of marijuana in some of the states, it's caused the drug traffickers to revert more to the heroin because that's where they're getting their money, the heroin and the fentanyl. So there's all kinds of ways to combat this. But yeah, it's a constant battle because you have to really hit it from as many angles as you can. And so we're still in York working hard with the education. We've done approximately 130, 140 presentations in the last 2.5 years throughout the community. We're still working with our heroin task force, which is now the York Opioid Collaborative, and trying to figure out ways to get naloxone into people's hands, how to find the gaps in treatment, how to get people better access to treatment. And we're still working with law enforcement to equip them with all the naloxone that they need, as well as educating our prescribers in the community. We have two entities, WellSpan and OSS, who are doing a terrific job with really decreasing their prescribing and changing their practices and making their patients more accountable, and all of that, all of those things combined, you know, we're really working hard to you know, help the addict too to get the help that they need. So,
you know, something you just mentioned, I think it's worth repeating. One of the reasons we did this show is Lancaster County District Attorney Craig Stedman was on the program a few weeks ago. We were talking about a different aspect of this, and he mentioned that to me off the air about the kind of the side effect, if you will, of states legalizing marijuana for recreational use is that, you know, a lot of people over the years have said, well, you know, if we legalize this, the state takes some money in taxes that, you know, you won't have the drug trade you have now. But he mentioned that one of the things that is happening is that though in those states where marijuana has been legalized, that the dealers who are selling marijuana are just what you said, now turning to heroin and other harder drugs to make their money.
That's what I've heard. I'm not with the district attorney's office in York, but that is what we're hearing. And I will say that we worry about that in the coroner's office as well as local law enforcement, because we do believe it's a gateway. And, you know, I can show you all kinds of data that show that most of my decedents have many of them have marijuana in their system when they've been using the heroin or the fentanyl. Not all of them, but many of them. And many of our traffic crashes involve marijuana. So it's definitely leading to poor decision making, just like alcohol does. And we have deep concerns that, you know, once marijuana is legalized, that our problems are just going to intensify.
Andrew Gilger is a paramedic, and he is performance improvement lieutenant with Lancaster EMS. As I mentioned, District Attorney Stedman on the program a few weeks ago, and he actually suggested this. He said, you know, if you really want to talk to people who see this every day, talk to our paramedics, talk to our first responders, because they do see it all. So I'll start with kind of a broad question to you. What have you seen?
Well, an increase, as my counterpart here said, over the last number of years, steadily increasing numbers for us personally. Over the last year or so, I couldn't count the number of overdoses that I've gone on, and I'm only running on the truck a couple days a week in conjunction with my administrative duties, but we're seeing repeat offenders. We're seeing people back 2, 3, 4 times, some of them making it through that excursion, and some of them not. I looked up some stats late last week just to kind of, you know, prep for today, and found one gentleman that we were out for 3 times, and the 4th time, he was dead. So we're seeing that more and more every day.
See, now, you know, one thing that I mentioned in the introduction that has been a game changer to a degree is naloxone, that you are equipped, many first responders across the state are equipped with this antidote that can, you know, literally bring people back from the dead. You know, I won't say it was an argument against it, but a warning was that you bring these people who are overdosing back, they're going to go right and without a treatment option or a way to force them into treatment, that they're going to keep doing it over and over and over. And you found that.
Well, and it's true. And there are steps being taken even now to try and get ahead of that. We've started carrying pamphlets from a specific organization down in Lancaster County that offers treatment, giving them to people on the way into the hospital. There are plans in place to start a program when we call our reports into the hospital to notify the receiving facility that we're coming in with a revived overdose that has given us permission to get counseling for them, essentially. And they'll have a counselor in the emergency department at some point within a short period of time to start talking to them. So there are other steps going on, other things happening to try and combat it. But, you know, you're right. It's an evil thing, man. When it gets a hold of people, it doesn't want to let go.
You know, I don't want to get too graphic here, but because you have witnessed this, when someone is overdosed, what's it look like? I know that's a...
Sometimes, yeah. Well, it depends. If they're really, really overdosed, they could look pretty close to dead. Honestly, breathing maybe 2, 3, 4 times a minute, you know, and a gasping kind of agonal breathing. So, you know, there's a short amount of time, you know, that you have to open an airway, give them some oxygen, control their airway and breathe for them and administer the Narcan, you know, to pull them back up and start them breathing again. Breathing is good. It's one of those things that we all have to do. Yeah. And, you know, the respiratory depression is what really kills people.
Yeah, that's what is that what you find most of the time, that overdoses, that it is they stop breathing. And the Narcan,
yes, sir.
Narcan is the name brand for naloxone.
Naloxone, yeah.
What most people use. But usually, is it a respiratory thing that kills them?
Yeah, and if they go 4 to 6 minutes without proper oxygen, they're going to have irreversible brain damage. So, if not death. So, yeah, you have a very narrow window.
There are certainly consequences that may even be, you know, some people would consider worse than death, you know, because if you have that irreversible brain damage, you end up in a vegetative state or something. And these are typically younger people.
Do you recognize overdose as soon as you see? I mean, a lot of times it sounds as if there may be somebody still
painfully
with a needle
obvious.
In their...
Yeah. Typically we do. I mean, it's a very set group of symptoms. Now there are some, you know, always some outliers, but a lot of times you're finding drug packaging equipment, you know, or paraphernalia close by, needles, obvious, you know, use of some kind, or they're with somebody that knows them and they know that they're an addict. They know that they use, and they'll pass that information along to us.
Heroin, as we've established, that heroin and now laced with fentanyl, has that made it even more difficult? Has that changed this at all?
Oh, absolutely. The more potent the drug, I mean, there are patients that we don't have enough Narcan in our bag to get them up and functioning again, or, you know, even get them breathing adequately again. We have to go to, you know, managing their airway, breathing for them on the way into the hospital, even though we're giving them these drugs to try and reverse the narcotics. It's potent, and I don't think some folks understand how potent, you know, or they think, oh, good, it's a really good batch, and, you know, we'll do a little more, and they end up down and out.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about the opioid crisis on the ground, those who have seen the results of overdoses. Our guest today, Andrew Gilger, who is a paramedic. His title is Performance Improvement Lieutenant with Lancaster EMS, and York County Coroner Pam Gay. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that's 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Nathan in Harrisburg. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment on two quick stories regarding treatment options that are known but not very well used or used at all. The first story has to do with a doctor, Alexander Shouts. After getting his BA in 1968, worked with a clinic in opioid withdrawal using megadoses of vitamin C and was getting very good results with that, but was shut down. And he went back, got his PhD, found out that a lot of times when the addicts went back into the streets to use heroin, the vitamin C was blocking the opioid receptor sites in the brain so that the person wasn't able to get high. The second story has to be a personal one in the sense that in the late 70s, myself and a few other people used acupuncture for the treatment of withdrawal for heroin addiction, and that was funded by the National Institutes on Drug Abuse. And our treatment methods was taught to us by a doctor, H.L. Nguyen, who was a neurosurgeon in Hong Kong. When I visited his clinic in 1978, he was using naloxone then to bring on the withdrawal symptoms of addicts, use the acupuncture treatment methods to get them through that, and he got them through major withdrawal symptoms within a 24 to 28-hour period. But that information is there. It's at the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, yeah, and so on. But it is options that if people wanted to pursue additional options, they would have them.
I would say
so
additional.
I just wanted to put that out there.
All right. Thank you very much. And I would say additional because, I mean, this is something that has been going on for some time, and a lot of very, very smart people have been trying to find cures and find ways to treat people. You know, I don't think that anything, I don't know, I'm not a doctor, so I can't say that, but vitamin C doesn't sound like it would be the cure-all for everything, but hey.
I certainly appreciate his comments, but one thing I would add that This is not the heroin of the 60s and 70s, and I have to point that out over and over again. I'm not saying that some of these things wouldn't work over time, maybe with some individuals, but, you know, what's happening is this is so much stronger, and when they have been abstinent for a period of time and they use, they actually die so much faster than what they would have, because they have no tolerance built up. And so while, you know, these are interesting options, and I've heard of acupuncture actually being used. You got to remember, you can combat that withdrawal, but you're still dealing with the mind that's not totally cured and not ready to go into total sobriety. Quite often needs some, you know, counseling, support, all kinds of things to help them get to that point where they can maintain sobriety for more than 48 hours, for more than the next 4 days, that they won't have triggers that cause them to start using again. And that takes sometimes years and months. I mean, months and years. And it's just hard to do in an overnight experience or 2 day experience.
There are some drugs now being used to fight addiction. And you mentioned me when we were off the air that you didn't used to think they were effective, but you're changing your mind on that.
Well, I like a lot of people, as a nurse, had not worked around addiction that much, although I had experienced in my own family, not heroin addiction, but my niece had been addicted to crack and alcohol. I raised her children for 5 years. So I learned quickly about addiction about 10 years before I took office. But I really did have in my mind that with heroin, you're replacing one thing with another with methadone. I have had a whole enlightenment since I became coroner, because what we were seeing is all these heroin deaths were coming across our desks. The toxicologies were showing us over and over again that these individuals had died just out of rehab, just out of prison, just out of a recovery house, or maybe in a recovery house. And they had tried to be abstinent for a period of time. And what was happening is they use once or twice. And as I said, they have no tolerance and they die. So I really rarely saw people dying from methadone, Suboxone, and we still don't. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but it's really rare. And many of them, if they do die from that, it's illegally obtained, or they're not in part of a program or a clinic. And so it just made sense to us that methadone and Suboxone seem to be working for some people as a way to get to their sobriety. And now Vivitrol's out there too. And we're using Vivitrol as a pilot program in our prison for reentry as they go back into society. And we're having some early success with that here in York. And we're hoping that that continues. So we're definitely big proponents of medication-assisted treatment for some individuals. And we realize that actually for some people, a year later, their chances of survival are so much better than if they go through an abstinence-only program and not, you know, and then use that once or twice and die. And so that's our concern. We need to look at all approaches. Abstinence is great for some individuals, but for this particular heroin addiction in York County, it's not working so well. We have to be open to decreasing that stigma of medication-assisted treatment.
Andy, you know, I hate to have to ask you these on-the-ground kind of questions,
okay,
but, you know, again, I said in the introduction that so often we talk about this, it almost seems like an academic discussion because either we've never witnessed it, we don't know someone who has died of a heroin overdose, although there are many more people, because there are more people dying who know of people like that. But as far as someone going through withdrawal symptoms, I mean, have you treated people? I mean, you've been called to a scene where someone is going through withdrawal, and I don't even know how you treat them at that point.
Well, it's supportive treatment in any situation like that. And, you know, honestly, the caller mentioned it. If you give maybe too much Narcan too fast, you can actually put people into withdrawal just by giving them the Narcan. Our goal when we're waking people up is just that, bring the respiratory rate up, wake them up enough that we can deal with them, but not blast them so we block every bit of the narcotic in their system and put them into withdrawal. Then they start vomiting all over the place and things get ugly pretty quick. Treating the withdrawal part of it is really more supportive care. I mean, there's not anything that we're going to do acutely unless, of course, you know, they would have seizures or something like that that we could give other medications to treat.
I said that Narcan has been a game changer. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, the availability of Narcan, I think, yes, it has. We've carried Narcan, I mean, it was invented in the late 60s, early 70s, and it's always been part of the med bag that I've carried.
Oh,
I've
really?
Been a paramedic for 27 years.
So everyone kind of thinks this is new.
It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not. The other thing to keep in mind is the Narcan will work if they still have a pulse, if they're still breathing a bit. If they've already gone into cardiac arrest, you can dump as much Narcan as you want into them, and it's not going to change it. You have to go to the standard start CPR, manage the airway, do the kind of things that we would do for anybody else that's in cardiac arrest.
So to say that someone could be brought back from the dead is a little bit too dramatic?
Touch. It's pretty close, and it certainly looks that way. When you wake someone up that's breathing one or two or three or four times a minute, and all of a sudden they sit up and take a big breath and go, what happened? It's pretty interesting to watch. But, you know, it does take its toll. It takes its toll on providers going out day after day for the same people. It was 4% of our call volume last year. We ran over 20,000 911 calls in Lancaster County. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but that's a pretty good pile of calls. And the amount of effort, the amount of doses that we're giving, the amount that it costs everybody in so many ways, it's almost unfathomable some days.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some phone calls. Tommy is in York. Tommy, you're on the air.
Thank you. My thought, I'll give you just a little bit of background that I have. I've 26 years working in the operating room. I never, ever saw this, okay? So I'm not talking about treating people who are drug addicts, but what my thought is prevention. I have never heard anybody say that they are going to start a program going into schools using police, doctors, EMTs, nurses, people who have witnessed this, and people who are quite knowledgeable about the situation, and approach these kids before the age where they get involved. I know you have statistics on this. Use your statistics and start with the kids who are younger, who are not yet involved, and show them in videos or whatever you have what can happen. Show them how they can be approached, the various ways that they can be sucked into this, and try to really zero in on prevention by a lecture program in schools, in churches, out into the community, and make it an ongoing thing. I hear this problem constantly, so why can't you have a program whereby it is a constant approach of prevention?
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Actually, I don't think that's accurate. You've been doing that.
I would say the York Opioid Collaborative, which was once the York Heroin Task Force in York County, has presented approximately 130 times since July of 2014. We've been very active. It started in a church, actually a high school and then a church. And we have done our presentation. In our task force, we have members of law enforcement. We have members in the medical community. Many of us kind of all do, you know, work together, and we don't always have a doctor, a nurse, but we tend to have at least some of those individuals involved in our presentations. We do get into the schools in York County. We partnered with Burns Education, who actually is doing much of the health education center there in York, and they're doing much of partnering with us and going into the schools also. So I would say there are a large number of schools that we've gotten into in York.
Age group, by the way?
Middle school. Starts at middle school. Middle school and high school. Some of the schools have had us in for a week-long series, us and York Adams Drug and Alcohol. Not One More we partner with, who are the families who've been impacted. We have mothers tell their stories to the students. That's always quite moving to see a mother who's lost her son to heroin, who goes around with us and tells her story. So yeah, we're very involved in doing that in the schools in York County. And the problem is it's still there. It's not going to go away. It's going to take a while. But we do believe that is one facet of combating this problem. And we're very fortunate that our heroin task force, which is now the York Opioid Collaborative, feels that that's still a very important thing. We've been doing it now for 2.5 years in York, almost 3 years, actually.
Let's go to Steve in Enola. Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing well.
Just like the last caller said, I feel that what you're doing with this Narcan is just following these addicts and giving them a safety net where they can feel they can just do it, you know, keep continuing to do it. I think more of the education would be more effective to spending the time and resources and money for education. You know, they get to that point. I do feel for the addicts. Don't get me wrong. I had a friend who died of this, you know, the heroin. I know it's a bad thing going on right now, but, you know, if you keep coddling these addicts, and, you know, like you said, 3, 4, 5 times they OD, and then they end up dying anyhow. I mean, I just feel that money and resources could go elsewhere.
Steve, thank you very much for your call. Pam Gay, you're kind of shaking your head, but I mean, that is an argument that you all, the both of you have heard, I know, that, you know, if you're going to be treating the same person 2, 3, 4 times, then and they keep doing it.
It's a disease. You have to you have to accept that. If you don't accept it's a disease, you can't understand. And honestly, I didn't used to think it was a disease, but you have to see the whole chemistry behind it, which I've already referred to a little bit. But at the same time, and I would argue that we resuscitate the chronic smoker who respiratory arrests, who might have a blockage in their heart. We don't, you know, and I respect his opinion and I understand that. But you have to take this from all angles. And we don't, I've actually had people tell me you should put a Sharpie, you know, mark their ear for the third time, you know, don't resuscitate them. And I, you know, I understand that concept, but you have to realize that this is a disease, and with the chronic smoker, we would, you know, who has heart disease, or the you know, maybe the person that's not listening to their doctor, not exercising, they keep eating donuts, you know, whatever. And I know that sounds trivial, but I'm not trying to trivialize it. I just want people to understand. I say this over and over again. We don't ever stop defibrillating that person. If they would code 25 times over the next 10 years, we would never walk past them and not try to save their life. And that's exactly what we're doing here with this. It's a different way of saving their life, but it's still very much part of our job as healthcare providers. We are to do no harm. We're to preserve life. And so we do what we can over and over again with the hope that someday we might be able to talk them into treatment. You can't save somebody who's dead.
Mm-hmm. We only have a minute or so left. Andy, someone who sees this on a, unfortunately, almost a daily basis, and maybe that's exaggerating a little bit, but you're seeing it very often.
Yes.
What kind of message would you like to leave out there?
It's an insidious disease, and when it gets a hold of people, I said this earlier, you know, it's very difficult to get away from. And yeah, we can come out over and over again and wake you up, and I will agree with my colleague here, you know, we don't let people that eat Twinkies and chug liter bottles of soda lay on the street to die if they fall over from a heart attack. So how are we going to leave these folks out there? Maybe wax poetic for a minute. I recall an old Neil Young song, The Needle and the Damage Done, a little part of it in everyone. And that goes through my head a lot of days when I see people out that we can't resuscitate, or when we wake people up and I'm having that conversation with them on the way to the hospital about, you know, you were a minute away from being dead. Don't you think you want to try and do something about this? And, you know, hopefully with all the efforts that are going on, that at some point we'll start turning that corner and making a difference.
York County Coroner Pam Gay and Andrew Gilger, who is a paramedic, performance improvement lieutenant with Lancaster EMS. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The Manatee Conservancy, Dauphin County's land trust, is teaming up with the Appalachian Audubon Society to celebrate its 20th anniversary with a special event this Thursday, April 27th. The theme will be Designing for Beauty and Biodiversity. One of the keynote speakers is Dr. Douglas Tallamy, professor and chair of the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, and author of the award-winning book, Bringing Nature Home. Dr. Tallamy, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Scott. Pleasant to be here.
Also joining us is Richard Zeno, who is president of the Manatee Conservancy Board. Mr. Zeno, welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Doug Tallamy, I'm going to come to you in just a second talking about some of the things that you want, the messages you want to get across when you're speaking at the event on Thursday. But Rich Zeno, let me start with you, because, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are, you know, support conservancies, know a lot about conservancies. Our audience in particular is very environmentally cautious. So I may be asking a question that they'll say, boy, that's a kind of a very simple question, but I'll ask it anyway. What is a conservancy?
So a conservancy is an organization, usually a charitable organization, that works to protect natural, agricultural, scenic, and historic resources, or any combination of that, usually by acquisition of land, either through easement, donation, or purchase.
Mm-hmm. So land conservation, why, I think this is kind of one of those common sense questions with answers, but why conserve land? And what is the value of this?
It's a very good question. I think the two immediate obvious answers are aesthetic and biologic. That is, it's beautiful and it brings joy, happiness to us. In terms of biology, it's for the maintenance of biodiversity, providing habitat for insects, invertebrates, amphibians, mammals, birds, as well as the flora. Right now, we see those woodland ephemerals in bloom. So, you know, the Dutchman's breeches and squirrel corn, Virginia bluebells, and all of that. All of that requires intact habitat in order for it to be maintained. But beyond that, woodlands serve as a sponge for carbon. They provide increased oxygen during respiration. We also see that riparian buffers are very effective in mitigation of stormwater runoff. This part of the state has seen a lot of suburban development, a lot of new roads put in, a lot of driveways. We have trouble with stormwater management. It also purifies in terms of agricultural runoff, nitrates and phosphates that won't reach Chesapeake Bay. We also have all the hydrocarbons and things resulting from the use of cars on the highway. And finally, there are actually medical benefits. It's found that for people who are out walking in the woods, it decreases stress. High blood pressure is reduced. It's been effective even in management of post-traumatic stress disorder in returning servicemen from the Mideast.
You know, with the theme of the event on Thursday night, where you're talking about beauty and biodiversity, you're really kind of talking about two different things, even though, you know, they are both very important. But I think back maybe 20, 30 years ago, and the things that we're discussing right now, beauty probably would be the number one thing that would come to mind. But what you just described there at the end of your answer is so important today, that biodiversity and how it is important to our health, maybe even our survival someday, that, you know, we need these things that you're talking about. I mean, this is not just a group of people who have gotten together and say, you know, we got to preserve the land because it's beautiful.
That's correct. It's not just feel good. This is really critical to our future. One of the things that I didn't mention as well is that it's also economically beneficial, that stormwater mitigation and purification results in tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of benefit within simply the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania by the purification that is not needed additionally, and by the stormwater management that's not needed, additional ponds and retention ponds or that sort of thing. It is critical. And certainly with global climate change that we've seen in the past and predict in the future, it's going to be more critical that we have corridors by which wildlife can move to places that are going to be more conducive to long-term retention of health.
Let me bring Doug Tallamy in. Dr. Tallamy, you know, I think I mentioned in an email to you, and this is no surprise, that one of the most popular topics on our program over the years, when I say popular, I don't just gauge that by people calling in. I gauge it by things I've heard afterwards and comments that we've gotten, is shows that we've done about pollinators, for example. That a few years ago when we started talking about honeybees and losing the population of honeybees and other pollinators, that, you know, at first people say, well, why is this so important? But over the years, they have learned how important pollinators are to our ecosystem and actually our health and our survival, our food supply, all those things. So my broad question to you is, are people coming around to that thought that, you know, it is not just feel good, as Rich Zeno said, that we're talking about the health of our, you know, the human race, for example?
Right. They're starting to. I've been talking about this for about 12 years now, and I do see movement. I wouldn't rate the ecological IQ of our nation very high, though. We're so separated from nature, we just don't think we need it. But as we've been talking about, the plants and animals in our ecosystems are what run those ecosystems. And those ecosystems produce the ecosystem services, all the things that we need to stay alive. So having pollinators is not optional. It's essential, and we've relied on our natural areas to preserve them and all the other biodiversity that's out there. But, you know, we're discovering that's not enough. Those natural areas, those little patches of healthy habitat that we've left, are just too small. There's still a steady drain of species from those areas. So what I'm trying to promote is to change the way we landscape all the places where we live and where we work and where we farm, so that those places can be designed to contribute to local ecosystems instead of helping to destroy them. We've got to save biodiversity right at home these days. And we can do it. We can do it. We just have to choose the right plants and use more of them.
Well, you know, I have to say that one of the things you just said is one of the best ways I've ever heard it put, that saving pollinators, that, you know, it's not like an option that we have, that either we do it or we don't. It's not an option. We must do it. So what you've been talking about, and I think one of the things that you'll be discussing on Thursday night at the Manatee Conservancy event, is native plants. That native plants are better at supporting animals than plants from Asia, for example. I mean, so many of us over the years have brought plants from other places in our yards because aesthetically they look beautiful. We like them.
Right. yeah, we've landscaped for aesthetics only, and we haven't thought about the ecological functions of the plants we put in our yards. Let me just give you a quick example. We're really talking about producing insects, and of course, nobody wants to talk about that. But insects are driving the food webs that support almost all of the terrestrial ecosystems out there. So if I'm a chickadee and I want to reproduce, I need between 6,000 and 9,000 caterpillars just to raise one clutch. If I'm in a landscape that's filled with calorie pear and crepe myrtle and burning bush and ginkgo, all these plants from Asia, there aren't any caterpillars, so I can't breed there. And if we're landscaping, we've measured it, about 80% of the plants we use in our suburban and urban landscapes are introduced plants, almost all from Asia. So they're growing there, and they look pretty, but they're not doing their job the way a native plant community would do the job.
Mm. You say that big lawns are a problem. Why?
Well, we've got an area the size of New England in lawn right now. That's 45.6 million acres. We're still adding 500 square miles of lawn to the U.S. every year. I talk about raising the bar about what we ask our landscapes to do. You know, right now we've asked them to be pretty, and they're good at that, but they also have to sequester carbon. Lawn is terrible at sequestering carbon compared to all the other options. They have to manage our watershed, and it's plants that do that. The lawns actually are destroying our watershed rather than managing it. They're adding all those nutrients that we don't need. You get the sun-baked lawn in the summer and the water just runs off. They have to support those pollinators we talked about, and it's not just because we need them for our crops. 80% of all plants are pollinated by animals and 90% of all flowering plants. So if we lost our pollinators, we lose 80 to 90% of the plants on the planet. Again, not an option. And we have to, you know, it's plants that are pumping carbon back into the soil. Our soils could sequester seven times the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere right now. But the reason they're not is because we've taken the plants that pump the carbon into the soil away. We've got to put them back. And all of that is not happening where you have lawn.
You know, this seems like a conversation that you should have when you're purchasing those plants. Now, granted, I know that there's an economic motivation for those who are selling a lot of the plants from Asia, for example, but that people who sell these kind of plants should be equipped with the knowledge when you have that discussion. Say, okay, is this a plant that first of all, is a native plant and one that will help the ecology, help the environment. I mean, is that conversation happening at all now?
It is.
Yes,
and
it is.
We're seeing actually Manatee Conservancy sponsors an annual native plant sale. So Doug's talk will be on Thursday, not this Thursday, but the following
27th,
week, the 27th.
Right.
On the 29th in Hummelstown at Borough Park, we sponsor a native plant sale. And we're not alone in doing that. And what we're finding is slowly, and with increasing rapidity, actually, even commercial vendors that 20 years ago did not have many or any native plants now have them and they're promoting them. So I think that we're on the cusp of a change in the way that we're looking at landscaping. And I think I'm going to put a plug in for Doug and Rick Dark's book, The Living Landscape. It is a phenomenal thing because it combines aesthetics and biology and natural history into a single resource that just inspires someone to plant differently and to think about the landscape differently.
What kind of native plants would you have for sale?
We'll have perennials, we'll have shrubs, and we'll have some small trees as well.
What kind of trees, what kind of shrubs?
Oh, my God.
well, let me ask Doug this. Doug, what do you recommend for this area of the country, this part of Pennsylvania? You're from Delaware, the mid-Atlantic states. What kind of native plants?
That's a real good question, because what we've learned in recent years is that not all native plants are equally good at doing the things we've talked about. So which ones are the very best? We've learned that about 5% of the available genera are producing about 75% of the food. So things like oaks, willows, cherries, birches, those are in the just the top few. They're doing most of the work in our landscape. So we can have a diversity of plants, and we want a diversity of plants in our landscapes. But if you don't have those core genera, keystone genera, host with the most, whatever you want to call them, you're going to have a failed food web. So that's a really important point that we've just learned, and we're trying to get that message out there.
What can we do to help help local pollinators?
Well, you need to plant for the specialist pollinators. There are a lot of pollinators that will only go to one genus of plants. So, for example, around here there are, I think it's 12 species of bees, native bees, and we've got 4,000, by the way, that will only use goldenrod. So if you don't have goldenrod on your property, you've already eliminated 12 species. Mm. There's another, 11 or something that only use willows. If you don't have willows, you've eliminated another 11. And asters are really important. Sunflowers, helianthus is really important. So right down the row there, we want to have the plants that are supporting those specialists. And if you support the specialists, you're also supporting the generalists. When we plant, there's a lot of flowering plants, and a lot of them are not native, and the bees will go to them. But it's just a few species of generalist bees. And we see all these bees, a few bumblebees and a lot of honeybees, and people say, oh, good, I'm helping the pollinators. Well, you are. You're helping a few species. But that 4,000 species of native bees that are disappearing, you're not helping those.
Go ahead, Rich.
Just that we need to be very thoughtful in how we plant and where we plant. So obviously there are going to be some that will be suitable for wetlands. So the birch are really good there. And the oaks from, our forests are largely oak hickory in this particular area. And they will support a tremendous diversity of pollinators and insects in particular, those caterpillars. And the thing is that if we took a slightly different mental approach to landscaping, we would have profound effects. Where we have those lawns, we don't see any of the caterpillars. We don't see any of the insects. It's dramatic to see the fireflies in the evenings, particularly in late June and early July, in the areas that have not been treated with pesticides and herbicides compared to those where there are lawns. So we probably see 10 times to 20 times as many fireflies in the evening. That's just an aesthetic objective. But in terms
of... Is that a good barometer?
As a broad barometer, I could not say that that's correct. Doug, do you want to correct me on that?
I use that as an indicator of something you're doing right, because it takes a lot of things to have a firefly population. You've got to have leaf litter. That's where the larvae live. They're predators in leaf litter. And if we clean up and tidy up and throw away every little piece of plant that falls to the ground, you're not going to have fireflies. what you're doing is recreating the healthy forest floor community. And fireflies are an indicator of that. And that, of course, means you're returning nutrients to the soil, you're holding water, you're doing lots of great things. So fireflies themselves, you're right, they're not an important component of the food web. They taste terrible.
But they do indicate
a healthy ground ecosystem.
Yeah, I think one of the other things is that right now for us, like we have a couple of meadows and we pretty much passively manage them. So what we do is mow once a year in the early spring, and then we have goldenrod and asters that self-propagate. So we're not doing anything there. Much more insidious and problematic for all of us in Pennsylvania in this area are the alien invasive species. So it's the honeysuckle bush, honeysuckle vine, multiflora, oriental bittersweet, mile a minute weed. The list goes on and on. Managing that is really difficult and challenging.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. And if I said this Thursday, I misspoke. It is April 27th. So rich information, if someone would like to support the Manada Conservancy, or if they would like to attend the event.
What I'd say is our website is www.manada.org. Our office phone is 717-566-4122, and you can email us at office@manada.org.
Rich Zeno, who is the president of the Manada Conservancy Board, Dr. Doug Tallamy, professor and chair of the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, and author of several books. Dr. Tallamy, Rich Zeno, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, the Nuclear Energy Caucus in Pennsylvania.